and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 18th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast to go with a special Science Magazine section on drug resistance. We'll hear about how quickly bacteria become resistant to drugs designed to kill them, how changes in natural ecosystems are perhaps altering microorganism resistance, the particular challenges of dealing with pathogenic fungi, and a special program in Russia for treating people with tuberculosis.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Bacteria were here first, and we've evolved around them. They're in our bellies, on our skin, everywhere, outnumbering us even in our own bodies, with estimates ranging from 10 to 100 times as many bacteria in and on our bodies as there are human cells. But sometimes, for example, bacteria on your skin may get into your bloodstream, where they might multiply and overwhelm your immune system, meaning it's time to take an antibiotic. But as contributing correspondent Gary Tobbs reports in this week's Science, there are fewer and fewer antibiotics being developed, and the ones out there are quickly becoming useless.
This article is about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This is a problem that's been around as long as antibiotics has, so in a sense, there's nothing new about it, but it just keeps getting worse. So we develop new antibiotics, and the bacteria develop resistance to our new antibiotics, and the bacteria spread the resistance. And now if you go into a hospital, or you can get even these infections in the community that are resistant to virtually all antibiotics. The latest evidence is that serious infections caused by one of the scariest of these bacteria, known as methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA for short, MRSA. Last October, the CDC reported in Journal of the American Medical Association that serious infections caused by MRSA numbered around 100,000 a year, with almost 19,000 deaths related to these infections. And as a accompanying editorial pointed out, that's more deaths related to this one bacteria than were attributed to HIV/AIDS in the same year. So what we have is a serious problem that tends to fly under the radar, in part because it's such an old problem, and in part because there's so little that can be done about it.
Where are these bacteria generally found?
Well, these bacteria are everywhere. These infections are particularly problematic in hospitals because it's when you go into hospitals and nursing homes that you have people whose immune systems aren't all they could be. And these bacteria can be moved sort of from the hospital into your system. Or actually, a lot of these infections are caused when your own bacteria end up in places they're not supposed to be. So bacteria that normally live in the sinus cavities get into the bloodstream, or the bacteria that live on your skin get into the bloodstream or into your joints. And if these bacteria are resistant to antibiotics, then you have a problem. And one of the things that happens when you get treated with antibiotics is you tend to wipe out your natural bacterial flora, and then a strain of bacteria that lives in the hospital that's resistant to the antibiotic you were treated with will move in and take over the void that's created when the antibiotics wipe out your own bacteria. So many of the infections we get are caused when you use antibiotics, it wipes out your own natural bacterial flora, and then a resistant strain moves in and takes over, and now you've got problems.
How widespread is antibiotic resistance among bacteria?
Well, it's extremely widespread. It's particularly a problem in hospitals and healthcare systems, although the problem today that's for the past half dozen years or so that has really captured people's attention is, again, this MRSA bug, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Back in the late 90s, this started showing up in the community. Now, this was a hospital infection. Suddenly, you start seeing this bug appearing in the community in children who've had no contact with hospitals. And this community strain of methicillin-resistant bacteria has now spread. So that's now in a community about 30 to 50% in some areas of this particular bug is found already resistant to methicillin and other similar antibiotics.
Historically, how long does it take after the introduction of an antibacterial drug before a bacterial strain emerges that's resistant to it?
Oh, in some cases, it's a year or two. This methicillin resistant, they introduced methicillin in 1959, and by 1961, you had methicillin resistant strains. Penicillin was introduced in 1943, widespread use. Within a couple of years, 20% of all Staph aureus around the world was resistant to penicillin. And what's interesting is the first strains of penicillin-resistant Staph aureus that occurred within a few years of the introduction of penicillin had naturally occurring enzyme, a penicillinase, or a beta-lactamase, as it was called, that destroyed the ring structure of penicillin. So even before penicillin was introduced, biologists had identified this particular penicillinase, this enzyme that could destroy it, on bacteria, on Staph aureus. So once we introduced penicillin, what happened is this bacteria that naturally carried this enzyme that could destroy penicillin had a survival advantage, and this was a strain that then spread around the world.
Even if one bacteria species develops resistance to an antibiotic, won't that antibiotic still be effective against other bacteria?
Well, it will be effective against other bacteria, but one of the things that these bacteria do is they exchange genes, and sometimes whole sequences of genes, between different species. So these bacteria play this kind of juggling act. They just pass these genes back and forth between them. And once you see resistance to one in one particular species, you have to worry that you're now going to see it in others as well.
Well, if the key to treating bacterial infections is new antibiotics, it seems like there would be a lot of antibiotics in the drug development pipeline.
Well, it does seem that way, but there's a couple of problems with antibiotics as a business. The development costs are virtually no different than they are for any other drug, you know, an antihypertensive or an antidepressant or a statin drug. But you're going to prescribe the antibiotic for, you know, 3 days, a week, 2 weeks maximum, where these other drugs you can prescribe for months, years, a lifetime. So the payoff from developing, you know, an antidepressant or an antihypertensive compared to an antibiotic is tremendously higher.
So even if there are perhaps millions or even billions of people who might be on an antibiotic for 7 or 14 days, that's not enough.
It's enough. You know, companies would pursue it, but bacteria fight back here. So, you know, the body doesn't evolve resistance to a drug developed to lower its blood pressure. But the bacteria are, there's sort of two parties in the antibiotic game. And not only that, the better the drug, this is the real irony in this business, the better the drug, the more likely it is that the sort of thought leaders in the antibiotic field are going to tell you not to use it. And in fact, there have been instances where the FDA has hesitated to approve a drug for certain cases because they didn't want the drug to be overused. If an antibiotic works, you want to keep it working as long as possible, and you want to save it for the really hard to deal with cases. So you want to make sure that it doesn't get overused. So there's a lot of problems unique to the field of antibiotics that works against the business model. And as a result, most of the companies that had really active antibiotic development programs in the 60s and 70s have left the business. There's only about a half a dozen left. And there's only about a half dozen antibiotics at the moment in the pipeline to fight one of the two major types of bacteria. There's what are called gram-positive bacteria and gram-negative bacteria, and there's a half dozen drugs in the pipeline against gram-positives, which are many of the most common bacteria, like Staph aureus is a gram-positive. But against gram-negatives, there's virtually nothing, and that's where this is really getting frightening now. You know, it's probably not as bad as the daily papers make it out to be. But every researcher I spoke with had a, you know, nightmare scenario of their own, something that kept them up late at night thinking, oh my God, if this happens, what are we going to do about it?
That was contributing correspondent Gary Tobbs on the increasing threat posed by multi-drug resistant bacteria. Read his article in this week's Science. Widespread use of antibiotics has only been going on for a few generations, but the large majority of antibiotics, as well as the antibiotic genes acquired by human pathogens, each have an environmental origin, with perhaps millions of years of evolutionary history. In a perspective in this week's Science, Jose Luis Martinez writes that changes in the natural ecosystem, including the release of large amounts of antimicrobials, might make it even more difficult to predict the consequences for human health. I spoke with Martinez from his office at the National Biotechnology Center in Madrid, part of Spain's National Research Council.
Antibiotics, probably the most important drugs developed by humans for treating diseases, has been always investigated from the clinical point of view. And the origin of most of the antibiotics currently being used in clinics is the soil. And in fact, in the first really important work on this, the idea of finding antibiotics in soil was an ecological idea. There are not usually regular human pathogens in soil, so Woodruff and Waxman in the 1940s said that, well, if there are not those pathogens in soil, probably it's because there must be something that killed those pathogens. From this, it came the idea that antibiotics should be there, and they were there. And the idea came that maybe antibiotics, the role, and their environmental role, it was to kill competitors, and resistances was to avoid being killed by competitors. However, in the last years, some people, including ourselves, believe that maybe there are some other functions of antibiotics and antibiotic-resistant genes in soil or water. Because if you, for any chemical entity, probably if you put enough amount, enough concentration of this chemical entity, will be toxic.
So people used and developed antibiotics to kill particular bacteria, and you're saying that in smaller doses, like those found in natural environments, in the soil, these same substances play a different role?
Yes, this is one idea that can be signals at low concentrations, because low concentrations of antibiotics trigger specific response of bacteria. And on the other hand, some molecules that are well-known signals, interbacterial communications involving quorum sensing, has been demonstrated that they have antibiotic properties. And it's quite interesting that the same molecule can serve as intercellular signaling for members of the bacterial species very close to the producer, but can have toxic effect about other members of other bacterial species. So it's a sort of dual role of signal and toxic compounds that may have at low doses in natural environments.
Then, other than in the environments of our own bodies in which we're putting in lots of antibiotics, is there some other way that altering the natural environment has affected antibiotic resistance?
Well, that's a very good question that we have to address. What can happen when you modify the soil because of contamination, because of global warming, or because of whatever you like? We know already that, at least in laboratory conditions, heavy metals, fundamental contamination of the industrial societies, can select for resistance. We know that some biocides can select for resistance. And it is clear that antibiotics are very important for farming purposes right now, select for resistance. And one thing that is important is that fecal contamination, and remember that most waters around the world are not clean from fecal contamination, is important as well, because if the resistance has to be acquired from the environment, there has to be a contact. We already know the origin of some antibiotic-resistant genes, and I mean antibiotic-resistant genes that are now in human pathogens. And in all cases that a new antibiotic-resistant will emerge, it will come from the environment. So there is a lot still to do, and I think that it's a field that is largely ignored.
So this way of viewing bacteria resistance to antibiotics as ecological might help combat bacteria in a clinical setting in the future.
Yes, of course. This is something, but we have to remember that, of course, antibiotic resistance can be acquired by mutation, can be acquired by recombination in some occasions with members of our commensal flora. But new antibiotic resistant genes, all of the new antibiotic resistant genes are coming from the environment, not from the clinics. Bacteria are well susceptible to antibiotics, and they have been acquired resistance either by mutation, recombination, or by the acquisition of resistant genes. So any increase in resistance in the environment can produce an increase in resistance. in the clinics. So there is a connection. And the antibiotic-resistant genes that will come next are there already.
Jose Luis Martinez, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for phoning.
Jose Luis Martinez writes on antibiotics and antibiotic resistance genes in natural environments. You can read his perspective in this week's Science. It can take over 48 hours to diagnose a pathogenic fungal infection, but for many patients, that's too long. While there are only about 300 fungi that cause disease in humans, identifying the antifungals that act specifically against these pathogens is a challenge because of fungal diversity, individualized pathways for infection, and the use of multiple mechanisms for drug resistance. In a perspective in this week's Science, Brian Monk and Andre Goffaut write about how to outwit the multi-drug resistance of many fungi. I spoke with Goffaut from Belgium, where he works at the Université Catholique de Louvain.
There is a need to find a way to inhibit multi-drug resistance of pathogenic fungi. And this does not exist yet. When it develops, you cannot specifically inhibit this multi-drug resistance, which is increasing problem for pathogenic yeast and fungi.
Where do we find human pathogenic fungi, and what are some of the diseases they cause?
Well, for the human pathogens, of course, you find them in the human body, and you have really two locations. One is on the skin, which is not too worrisome, and the second is inside the body. And when it comes inside in the blood or in the liver or other organs, then it's a very, very dangerous. It kills. It kills humans once it gets at the stage of invasive in the blood.
How do current antifungals generally work to kill fungi?
Well, these are azoles. Azoles is a class of enzyme which modifies the composition of lipids in the membrane. And a special lipid which is specific to yeast is ergosterol. So it inhibits the synthesis of ergosterol, which is a membrane component and which is specific for yeast.
So the yeast can't form its...
its membrane, outer membrane, and then it stops growing. The problem is that they are fungi static. That means they stop growth, but they don't really kill the yeast. And this is a problem. So the yeast stays with this azole inhibitor and develop resistance. And this is a kind of special resistance called multidrug resistant, usually. But then you have many other ways, of course. For instance, some of those fungi agglomerate in a film. It is called biofilm, which then does not allow the drug to penetrate, to touch the yeast, and many other ways, yes.
What are the mechanisms of multidrug resistance?
Multidrug resistance is the increased activity of a pump which pump out of the cell the drug. So the drug, instead of going in the cell and killing, is being pumped out. Of course, that makes the cell resistant. The drug does is less efficient because most of it is pumped out again. So we have discovered this pump a long time ago, well, 1984, I think. The same kind of pumps called ABC transporter or MDR, multi-drug resistant transporter, which acts during chemotherapy of cancer cells. It's the same category of pump, and it's extremely general in many, many eukaryote species, very efficient, and it is increased by spontaneous mutation. So some mutation in yeast, if you treat the yeast with antifungals, it develops a mutation. Most of the time, the mutation is in a mechanism which activates those pumps.
So its response is to develop more pumps to pump the poison out.
Exactly, very clearly. And we have identified the transcription factor, which is responsible for that in yeast, and which is called PDR1. The mutations are in a transcription factor, and this mutation increases the expression, exactly.
Is that a potential drug target to keep those pumps from working?
Of course. If we could block that pump, we could really, it would help a lot. And this we have been trying to do, and Brian Bonk has been trying to do for years now.
Your co-author.
Yes, yes, others, of course. But he has tested millions of compounds, and unfortunately, so far, nothing is strong enough to be really used in clinics. But I think we should pursue this effort and screen more widely. So I still feel that there is some hope there to have something which inhibits those pumps.
Why is it difficult to target these pumps?
It's because these drugs are so unspecific. It's an extraordinary type of pumps which handles thousands of compounds of different structure, very different chemical structure. So no specificity. And so that's why it's difficult to block this active site, because it is, one needs something which would be specific, yes.
Are there any other new targets?
Yes. Actually, one of the biggest drug on the market, human market, is a drug which is called omeprazole, which inhibits a human proton pump in the stomach. When you pump out proton, you have positive charges outside and negative charges inside. So you build up an electrical gradient across the cell, and this gradient is the driving force for many nutrients to be pumped in the cell. So for this pump, which is the proton potassium pump in the stomach, companies have developed a specific drug which works well, and one of them is omeprazole. So it is possible to block those pumps, because the one which is in the fungi and plants are of the same class, the same really structure and mechanism, no doubt about it. So it should be possible to also find inhibitors for those drugs. It must inhibit the fungal and not the human one, so we have a narrow range of specificity in which we should act.
So there are similar mechanisms at play in the human cells as well.
Yes.
And so since a drug company has figured out a way to block that pump in a human cell, it shouldn't take too much to figure out a way to block that in a fungi as well.
It should be possible, let's say, with right funding and screening and investment, yes.
André Goffaux is corresponding author of A Perspective on Outwitting Multidrug Resistance to Antifungals. Read more about it in this week's Science. In Tomsk, Russia, there has been some success in dealing with tuberculosis, a deadly infectious disease of the lungs caused by bacteria. Science Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall recently returned from Tomsk and writes about it in this week's issue.
Russia's had a very serious problem with tuberculosis, and the reason for looking at it at this point is that they've spent 5 years trying to bring it under control with help from a lot of international organizations, most recently a group based in Boston called Partners in Health, which was invited in by the regional government in Tomsk, which is way out in central Siberia. Now they're evaluating where they stand, and also it's interesting because it's hoping to become a model for other places that might use the same methods for tackling very serious epidemics of tuberculosis.
What's characteristic of these populations where these epidemics are happening, either in Russia or around the world?
Tuberculosis is typically a problem of the poor. There's a tremendous reservoir of latent tuberculosis in the world. The World Health Organization estimates that there are 2 billion people in the world with latent tuberculosis. But it comes to the fore and flourishes really when nutrition is bad, when people are living in confined areas and stressful circumstances. So particularly in prisons and in hospitals and places where there's a lot of poverty.
What in particular then is happening in Tomsk in Russia?
Well, I traveled to Tomsk in June because they were having a sort of an evaluation and a training session there showing off what they had done. It was significant because they had a severe outbreak there throughout Russia in the 1990s with the end of the Soviet Union, collapse of the health system, collapse of the economy. The particular problem in Tomsk is there was a large prison. It has a capacity for 1,000 people. This is a prison hospital, in fact, which only had TB patients in it. they realized that they had developed a reservoir of resistant TB, which couldn't be treated with the normal drugs. And they were not only had a large population of resistant tuberculosis, but they were spreading it to the civilian population. So Tomsk developed a very aggressive program with the help of outsiders to try to turn back this tide of resistant tuberculosis.
Before we get to that, what makes tuberculosis so infectious, and then what makes it resistant?
Well, even the standard variety, tuberculosis, is a resilient bug. It's got a very unusual and, I'm told, unique kind of exterior coating, kind of waxy lipid that makes it difficult to penetrate and very hardy, and it's a great survivor. It sort of has this latent state it can go into as well and survives immune system attack and also chemical attack. It becomes resistant when it's exposed to a less than effective regime of antibiotics, so that in a course of therapy that's intermittent or with drugs that are not strong enough, the situation can select for survivors, the toughest of the tough, the bugs that will survive drug therapy, and they develop within their genetic code the ability to resist drugs, and they can pass it on to other organisms.
To combat these multi-drug resistant strains, is what's needed just more types of drugs to treat it?
A new drug would be very helpful. The crisis that they're facing in tuberculosis therapy is that there was an explosion of antibiotics that came after World War II, and basically through wide use, and in cases misuse, improper use, all these drugs are losing their potency, and we're actually at the end of the list now. We're coming to the very end of what was in the pipeline, and companies are not investing in making new antibiotics.
Why not?
They're not profitable. They're a lot of trouble. You run into a lot of political hassles as well. And so the major drug companies have backed away from the field. So yes, we do need new drugs. What we really need is a drug with an entirely new mechanism. And some of those are being developed mainly on a nonprofit basis. And there's a list of, say, 5 or 6 that are in the pipeline. Some of these are old drugs which have been modified and sort of re-engineered for the use against tuberculosis. But it's going to be 5 to 10 years before even the first of these is ready for being widely used.
What's being done then to treat the populations in Tomsk?
Well, in addition to using the standard therapy, it's a very complex cocktail of drugs, usually 4 at a time, to attack it. They're also bringing in what they call second-line drugs, which are those that have been put aside in the past because they weren't so convenient or had serious side effects, and bringing them in cases where they run into resistance. So you have up to 6 or 8 different drugs that are being used in combination in very elaborate kind of regimes. In addition, they are monitoring every TB patient in this whole district. They have a large database, and they have health workers who go out in a program, a companionship program, it's called, Sputnik is their term. This finds these patients when they don't turn up at the clinic, brings the medicine to them, and makes certain that they take it twice a day. So this is a very aggressive program to see that the therapy is sustained over a period which can last at a minimum for 6 months, and for resistant drug cases, for 2 years.
Is it likely that such a treatment plan would work in other places?
It can work where you have a well-developed infrastructure and a dedicated workforce. I don't think it can work in every country, and many countries may not be organized for this, or may not be, even the United States may not be sort of inclined to be so intrusive and pursue patients to the last degree at home.
Did you feel safe traveling into these prisons and hospitals where there were these cases of tuberculosis?
I didn't feel safe all the time. In the prison, actually, I felt safer than in the public hospital because they were more prepared for our visit, and we had gowns and masks to protect against, you know, inhalation of the resistant organisms. We met patients who were infected with multi-drug resistant TB, for which there really isn't any good cure. I mean, there are therapies. In the public hospital, which was not on the tour, the environment wasn't as clear. There wasn't good ventilation. I mean, the doctors had some very elaborate protective gear they were wearing, which I didn't have. I had a gauze mask. What you really want to avoid is acquiring what's called extremely resistant TB, for which there are no drugs that can be used now. I met some patients who had been infected with XDR-TB, as it's called, and they had been treated with surgery, just removed parts of their lung, and their TB was in a dormant state. So you really have to admire the health workers that work in this environment day in and day out, because they are facing a risk of infection with something for which we really don't have good treatments today. And a certain percentage of those workers do get sick every year. I mean, the hospital administrator was quite proud that they had reduced those infections among the health workers from what had been a high level of 5% down to virtually none in the year 2008. But it's a risk they face every day.
Elliot Marshall, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Science Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall reports on the extraordinary steps being taken in Tomsk, Russia, to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. Read his article in this week's Science. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back next week, and you can check out the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For now, that wraps up the July 18th, 2008 special science podcast on drug resistance. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.